keynote speaker this morning is coming up, and to introduce our keynote speaker will be Jenny Kalmanson. Jenny is a space systems engineer, and she also is very active in humanism. She's been active in the Washington area secular humanists for quite some time. She's on their board still, and she recently, within the last couple of years, joined the AHA board. I've enjoyed working with her, so please join me in welcoming Jenny Kalmanson.
Arthur C. Clarke once wrote that religion is the most malevolent mind virus ever created by humans. Reading Jeff Charlotte's The Family, one could easily agree. The product of years of research, including living for a time among the brothers at Ivanwall, a semi-monastic training facility for young evangelical leaders, The Family exposes a deeply pervasive and entrenched conspiracy to control worldly power in expectation of the imminent return of Jesus to his earthly throne. As much a vision for totalitarian social order as a religious belief, the meme promulgated by The Family is that only a chosen elite can properly prepare the kingdom of earth for the throne of heaven. There's Jesus for the select few in power, the Jesus who speaks directly to them, and then there's a less important Jesus who appeals to the masses. For The Family to execute on this elitist vision, they fiercely oppose any respect for individual human dignity, lest it lead to real democracy, taking power away from wealthy elites. It's no exaggeration to say that The Family openly admires the ruthlessness of warmongers like Genghis Khan and fascists like Hitler and Mao. Those guys got the job done. They subdued the masses. This is what was most important to The Family. So these guys really are out to get us. Everything we stand for, really. While it would be tempting to circle the wagons, as humanists, we have available to us a more measured, a more reasoned response. And Jeff Charlotte's book gives us another piece of information with which to formulate that response. Charlotte describes not only a cabal of committed elites, but their belief structure and method of spreading their means. How do they build key men in power centers around the world? Why do they themselves refer to their message as a contagion, a mind virus, if you will? From a pragmatic standpoint, the best way to combat a disease is to learn about it from an objective, clinical view. If one were to indulge the mind virus analogy, it would be by learning about how a group that calls its own meme a contagion propagates. This is the challenge before us. How are they doing this? Charlotte's book exposes the methods by which a person can be made receptive as a host to The Family's contagion. First, there's the idea that you're nothing without Jesus. New recruits at Ivanwald are systematically broken down emotionally, leaving them with no self-esteem outside their relationship with The Family and with their direct connection with what they perceive to be their Christ. Worldly power. It's no secret that The Family keeps its members connected directly to worldly power. The idea of being chosen. This is a pretty powerful concept. It doesn't matter what you do, or if you behave kindly or poorly to fellow people, God has chosen you specifically to lead. That's a pretty hard idea to not find seductive. Also, that might make right, because God chose you to have power. Whatever you choose to do with that power is the right thing to do. So it's a self-justifying cycle. And plus, there's permanence. Once you're in, you're in. No sin is too great to excommunicate you, save betrayal. That last point, betrayal, is the one which Jeff Charlotte has risked. His writing about The Family at all was considered a betrayal. One family member even declared him an enemy of Jesus. Yet he is still a member of the family. If he chose to go back tomorrow, to repent, to fully decry his work, he would be welcomed back as the prodigal son. That he has chosen instead to share with us, we secular humanists who are the only worldly thing the family really fears, the inner workings of their organization and his study of it, for this he should be praised for his commitment to fairness and social equity. Jeff Charlotte has given us a situational awareness of an organization bent on destroying our democratic way of life. Knowledge doesn't do any good, however, as a mere abstract. It is now incumbent upon us to decide as a movement what our response will be to organizations like the family. So, circle the wagons, imitate success, possibly at the expense of our moral high ground. The answers won't be easy, but thanks to Jeff Charlotte, at least we have enough information to start asking the right questions. Now, to give our keynote address at our 70th anniversary conference of the American Humanist Association, please welcome journalist and author Jeff Charlotte.
To all of you for having me here today. Jenny mentioned that I had at one point been declared an enemy of Jesus by a member of the family. That was actually in relation to another speaking engagement. I had been asked to speak in Berlin, a university there, in a speaking series sponsored by the U.S. Embassy. So I flew over to Germany and got off the plane, and my host meets me and says, there's a problem with the funding. And, you know, I've just come across the ocean. It's not the time to be told that there's a problem with the funding. It's nowhere. The university's gonna pick it up. He says, the embassy says they can't cover you. He says, the ambassador says that you are an enemy of Jesus. And I wondered who this was. It was then former Senator Dan Coats, who is now, once again, Senator Dan Coats from Indiana, a man who described Dan Quayle as his mentor. And back then, when I was writing about the family, being called an enemy of Jesus by Dan Coats, there was many within this organization who thought that was too extreme, who, as Jenny mentioned, if I had, you know, if I'd hung my head and come back and said, I am nothing, I'm ready to be used as a vessel for this ideology, they would have taken me back into the fold. That's kind of changed, actually, now. I wrote this book, The Family. I wrote another book called C Street, and just kept putting out there the fruits of my research, and finally reached a point where I was communicating with some members of the family, and they work oftentimes. They cultivate foreign leaders. I was, you know, talking with people who had, you know, knelt down in prayer and love and spoke of men like the late Sani Abacha, the terrible dictator of Nigeria, as a brother and as a beautiful man. And I would make this appeal to them. I said, you guys have got to keep speaking to me. I'm just a journalist. Can I really be worse than Sani Abacha, worse than Omar Bashir in Sudan? And the answer was yes. A journalist who keeps talking is worse than a killer. And that's a strange ideological place to be, for them and for me, I suppose. So I am apparently outside the love of the family, and they will no longer welcome me back, and I'm happy to be here with you. And this goes to something I also wanted to talk about. When you write a lot about religion and politics, you get invited oftentimes to the humanist organizations, and atheist organizations, and you also get invited to churches, since I speak a lot in churches. And there's a metaphor out there that I think a lot of us find very seductive, very, very tempting. It's the metaphor of common ground. The idea, can't we all find some common ground? We all stand together. And you know, given that I'm not included on the common ground that includes, say, Senator Coates and say a foreign dictator like Bagbo, Laurent Bagbo in Ivory Coast, also a friend of the family who's now being defended by family politicians because his opposition is Muslim. I'm not included on that common ground, so I'm not as fond of the metaphor of common ground. In fact, as a writer, I think about what that metaphor means, and I think about how that metaphor tempts us away toward the kind of critical thinking, the kind of activism, the kind of energy we need to bring to these questions of the place of religion in society. Common ground's a spatial metaphor, right? Common ground means we're all standing within maybe this circle. Common ground doesn't talk about what we're doing there or how we do it. Common ground, what's included in common ground? Common ground includes a plantation. Common ground is master and slave standing on the same ground. Common ground is a euphemism for the stronger faction's conventional wisdom. And the fact is, common ground is not how democracy works in the United States, and it's not how religion, belief, and unbelief, skepticism, and doubt, how they have interacted in the United States. So I wanted in this talk, instead of just going right to the family, the C Street, and the scary bad guys, talk about an earlier book of mine called The Heretic's Bible. Did with a friend, Peter Manso. We were curious about the varieties of religious experience in the United States. We spent a year traveling around the country. And when we left, we said, wouldn't it be great if this was like ancient times, ancient Greece, and we could pull into each new town and there would be, you know, some different strange religion, a different god. It's good for storytelling. That's good for us. And we were lucky, because it turns out there is. There are 1,000 gods in America. They just happen to all be named Jesus. But you find this character worshipped in so many different fashions. So we would spend time with people who would worship Jesus by falling tornadoes, people who would worship Jesus who they called the greatest cowboy. These are cowboy churches, a growing movement in the South, in country music, a cross made out of horseshoes. One church we went to, actually where you might find a painting of Jesus, they just had this beautiful portrait of a longhorn steer. This is getting off the coast of pagans, but we didn't want to tell them that. So we came back, we wrote the book, we do the publicity, and there's always that sort of that drive, that looking for common ground, that bad metaphor, common ground, you know, it's sort of enforced harmony, it's the lowest common denominator. And, you know, we would do interviews, and the interviewers would ask us, you know, is there some great sound of faith in America? We'd say, well, wait a minute, what do you mean faith in America? I mean, that's only one piece of this thing. There's belief, there's unbelief, there's faith, there's a whole faithlessness in this vast country in between, right? And we said, we prefer to think of it in terms of some of the sounds that we heard as we were traveling around. So we had visited a Buddhist monastery in Poolsville, Maryland, led by the first female tulku, which is supposedly a reincarnated lama in the West. And the whole thing was a little bit sketchy, and they were also, had been a sort of a former cultish group that had suddenly converted en masse to Buddhism and was doing quite well with that. They had a circle of crystals, which is not part of Buddhism, that they said was beaming out this prayer that they were saying 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The prayer would go, Om Mentar Sa To Sa Ma Ya, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So we would hear that, and then we went down the road and we went to a church in Broward County, Florida, and a member of the choir, had been killed by a serial killer, and they had caught the guy, and he had been on trial, he'd been convicted. He turned out to be something of a preacher himself. And they were gonna have a special choir to pray for good outcome in the sentencing, and they had invited the DA. This is a powerful gospel choir, and everyone had decided to wear red, because that's the color of blood. And that's what they wanted. They wanted the death penalty. They were very clear. They wanted the DA to understand that they wanted the death penalty. So they sang a great old gospel number, Power in the Blood, which you're not making the connection automatically. Think about the death penalty, the electric chair, power in the blood. This is a gospel choir. This is what they were asking for, so power in the blood. And we started thinking of that song, that old song, power, there's wonder-working power in the blood, and you mix that in with Om Benzar Sato Samaya. And at that point, we needed a break, and we went up to South Carolina, where, and I really recommend this, whatever your personal beliefs are, there's a great little vacation retreat run by the Baba lovers. These are followers of the late Mara Baba. And he insisted that he had fresh water and salt water. And so they found this beautiful piece of property in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. No cars, little huts you rent for $15 a week. And all you had to do is put up with the songs. And their songs, I mean, infantile. Baba Baba on the stoop, Baba Baba in my soup, Baba Baba in the air, Baba Baba everywhere. Adults singing this. But there were better songs, as we found out, various musicians. Some not so much better. Bobby McFerrin's Don't Worry, Be Happy, that this turns out to be a tribute to Baba. Bobby McFerrin's a Baba lover. But what really surprised us was the Who song, Baba O'Reilly. Better known as Teenage Wasteland. Which is a great song. It's a great song, and it has that you know, that, and I'm not going to sing it for you. See, I do favors for you. I don't need to be forgiven. That's the idea of that song. So you take all these songs, Om Benzar Sato Sama, you take Power in the Blood, you take The Who's Teenage Wasteland, and you mash them up all together, and you get not harmony, but cacophony. And this, to me, is the sound of democracy in America. A cacophony choir, many very different voices, a lot of them disagreeing sharply, coming together. That, to me, is a sound that I like. That is a metaphor I can live with much easier than common ground. And it became political for me. At this point, it was just aesthetic. It became political for me when I started doing the research for this book, The Family. While I was traveling around, I was invited to live in this house called Ivanhoe. Jenny told you about this, where sort of future leaders of this organization were being kind of trained. And I spent some time there and wrote about it for a magazine. And I went and I discovered they had dumped 600 boxes of documents in an archive, the Billy Graham archives in Wheaton, Illinois. So I moved out there and just went into those archives every day. And I found in these archives this incredible sort of alternate history of fundamentalism in America going back to the 1930s when the organization was founded by a man named Abraham Verghese. And he described what he wanted to do as creating a space for political decisions to be made as religious decisions. And he wanted to do it, and this was his phrase, beyond the din of the box populi. Beyond the din of the box populi, this pretentious little Latin phrase by which he meant beyond the voice of the people, beyond the cacophony. He was a great believer in harmony. This is 1935. He looked around the world. He saw fascism rising, and so that's very powerful. He saw communism, so that's very powerful. He did not think democracy could compete, and he wasn't interested in it. Instead, he saw this third way, this harmony that he could create with this organization. And I just want to make as an aside here, because I just learned coming here this morning that the Hyatt has had some labor troubles. And it's just kind of depressing to me, because I speak all over the country, oftentimes at hotels, they're always having labor troubles because they're always trying to lay people off, slash wages, and push back against working folks. And that may not seem any connection to the issues that you're talking about here today, but I want to tell you that fundamentalism, that the oldest and most influential fundamentalist organization in the United States, which is The Family, was founded in 1935 with one clear purpose: destroying unions. Unions, they thought, were an affront to God. They took the invisible hand very literally. The founder of the organization began in 1935. He said God came to him one night and told him that Christianity had been getting it wrong for 2,000 years. He had been organizing soup kitchens, doing various good works before that. God told him, forget it, don't bother, don't waste your time. Christianity, as he would understand it, is not for the masses, it's for the elite, those whom he would call the top men, the key men, the small group of people, politicians, business leaders. And he brought them all together. And the first big fight was against organized labor in the Northwest. And they won. And they elected a stridently anti-labor governor named Arthur Langley, who was One of his first moves was, he said, I want to have a law that will allow me to annul other laws. And he didn't quite get that far. And so he ended up governing as a kind of more of a standard issue conservative. But on the strength of that success, getting that man in office, the organization moved to the other Washington, United States, D.C., and they said, we have a message for the Capitol. And they began working with the National Association of Manufacturers to bring congressmen in to find out what God's message for the economy was. Because that's what they really thought it was. If we can get the economy, if we can get regulation out of the way, if we can undo the New Deal, get rid of FDR's reforms, we will unleash the power of a few key men chosen for leadership and power by God to do right by the rest of us. They'll take care of us. We trickle down fundamentally. So they had some successes. And they worked in the domestic sphere for a number of years. But I think they saw the Cold War. They understood what the Cold War was, actually a little bit earlier than I think a lot of American political figures, and sort of the right-wing politicians involved in that were very eager to fight communism. And they did so by developing this international ministry. And I just want to give you three dates to give you a sense of this thing, and then maybe bring us into the present. 1959 was the first time that they decided to reach beyond Europe, where they'd been doing a lot of work. They decided to reach beyond the developing world. A guy named Senator Frank Carlson from Kansas, with Senator Homer Capehart, known as Senator Snort, that was his nickname. Senator Snort was an odd character. He would go out on the floor of Congress and he would talk about the victims, these terrible victims of World War II, these men who were still suffering, these people who were left homeless. Who would take them in? Who were these people, the refugees? No, they were former SS men who he felt were being unjustly persecuted for having made mistakes during the war. So that's Senator Homer Capehart, who has his redeeming virtues. He also invented the jukebox. These things tend to get complicated. If there is a heaven, you know, there's sort of on the one hand, on the other hand. So they go, and these two guys get together, and they say, we need to find some leaders in the developing world, and they go to Haiti. They lead a delegation of businessmen, and they interview this guy, and hopefully some of you in the audience, the name will just ring a bell, and they come back, and they say, this is a man of God. They're both on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. They are in a position to do something about that, and they do. They begin the long U.S. relationship with that man's regime. His name was Papa Doc Duvalier. He was the man of God. One of the most vicious, lunatic dictators in the Western Hemisphere. Odd to call him a man of God, since he actually was very clear he was God. He thought he was calling himself the great electrifier of souls. But he was also good for business. And they went into business with him. A few years later, in Indonesia, Suharto, now the late Suharto, came to power in what the CIA, no bastion of leftist thought, called one of the worst mass killings of the 20th century. Scholars quibble, was it 800,000 dead, 1.2 million dead? The point is, it was a lot of killing. The family called it a spiritual revolution and began sending delegations of congressmen and oil executives who, in their reports, which would sometimes go all the way up. There's a one report file that was sent to Nixon from a group of senators and oilmen went over and described their hour with Suharto, the dictator, as one of the most spiritual hours of their lives. Now, Suharto was a Muslim. How did this work? Common ground. They found common ground around oil. Suharto wrote, in this way, nobody converts us, we convert ourselves. On it goes throughout history. 1983 in Somalia, they became champions of the late Siad Barre, who drove that country into rubble from which it's never returned. They started arranging meetings with the dictator with American defense contractors. They said, he's our brother in Christ. We have to share this common ground with him. He was always very clear. He says, I will pray to Jesus. He was a Muslim as well. He says, but I'll pray to Jesus. In return, I want meetings with the White House. I want my defense budget doubled. And I want a hands-off policy where I crack down on a little rebel group to the north. Family wrote back. These are the documents that are in the archives. Yes, done, and done. And so in the history books it was. And he cracked down on the rebel group in the north, and then he decided to go to the south and the west, then the east and the center. He raised the country. and they never turned away from him because he was a brother. So when I first published The Family in 2008, I made a mistake. I went out and I tried to do media about this. I tried to tell these same stories I'm trying to tell you, and you know, frankly, media was not much interested. Somalia. I remember there was one radio producer, this was before, kind of before the whole pirate thing got going. Radio producer said, "What's a Somalia?" Delicious kind of Indian food you can get with lentils or potatoes. There was no interest. These things didn't matter. And so the book kind of didn't really take off until, and maybe this was a point where I still was a brother in the family, they would still love me back. I'd like to think of a couple politicians, Senator John Ensign, Governor Mark Sanford, sitting around thinking, what can we do for Brother Jeff? His book just is not thriving. What can we do to get this out there, get that message out there in the news? And some of you may remember three politicians in the summer of 2009, all of them family values leaders, two of them presidential prospects, the third, Chip Pickering, not as well known, but maybe more influential in American life as the architect of the 1996 Telecommunications Act, which has done so much to demolish my business of journalism. But Sanford and Ensign, first there was Ensign, who turns out to be having an affair with his best friend's wife, who was his wife's best friend, and they were all on his staff. It got very confusing. And when this happened, I got some calls. Do you want to talk about this? Because I had met Senator Ensign. Senator Ensign lived in a house run by the family on Capitol Hill, the C Street House. Or as it's known by some bloggers, it's the Prey Boy Mansion. And they had helped cover up this affair. And this quickly came out that this religious organization was going to great ends to help cover this up. And in fact, had been party to an agreement with the cuckolded man, a former chief of staff of Ensign, to break lobbying laws that would still under investigation, that he was basically paying off the mistress and her family to stay quiet, $96,000 in payments of $12,000 so it wouldn't trip various IRS lines. This was all being done through this religious organization. And I had been in this house, C Street, I spent time there. That's where I really first encountered the kind of the theology of C Street, the theology that allows them to stand on the one hand by a guy like Senator Ensign, on the other hand, like by a guy like Papa Doc Duvalier. And there's a big divide between them. We do have to understand, we may not like Senator Ensign's politics, but he is not a mass killer. But there's something in this group that says, let's admire, let's look at Jesus. And Jenny sort of told you a little bit about this. And what's the common denominator of Jesus? And so they don't talk so much about justice or mercy or love. They talk about strength. And I'll quote Doug Coe, the longtime leader of the group. You can also see this on video. I've worked with NBC Nightly News, and we got some video of one of his sermons to a group of conservative evangelical leaders. He says, you know how Hitler said you know how Jesus said, you gotta put me before mother, father, brother, sister. Jesus does say this in the New Testament. He says, Hitler, Stalin, Mao, that's what they told the kids. Mao even had the kids killing their own parents, but it wasn't murder, you see, because it was for building the new nation, for building the kingdom. That's the model. They call it Jesus plus nothing. They're not neo-Nazis, they're not secret Maoists. They admire strength. It's the reduction of history, of theology for believers, of democracy for everybody, to this one focal point of Jesus, what they call Jesus plus nothing. Jesus, they say, as the greatest common ground of all, and at one point, one of them trying to sort of talk me out of writing this book said, you've misunderstood us, Jeff. He said, we only use Jesus because he's common to all belief systems. I want to tell my colleagues in the religious studies departments about this. I didn't learn this in religious studies 101. This is what Jesus and Christianity is. That's true. And they said, and Jesus is the goal of Islam. And I said, that's startling. But I understood the distortion they were talking about. Jesus is, of course, a prophet within Islam and is revered. I think about 99.9% of Muslims would disagree with the idea that he is the goal of Islam. And then, now from a Jewish background, he said, and of course, Jeff, you Jews love Jesus. I said, really? He said, right, because he's sort of like the big climax of the story, the big finale, right? And I said, wow. This, by the way, was a guy who served in several presidential administrations, an educated man. I said, no, the story kind of cuts off for the Jews before we get to Jesus. Jesus is not part of the story. And he just couldn't stop. He said, even atheists agree on Jesus. It's that kind of reductive thinking that allows you to see no evil when you're dealing with Papa Doc Duvalier, or in the more trivial example, with Senator Ensign, or with Mark Sanford, Governor Mark Sanford. He's really the turning point for me, and maybe I'll tell you a little about Sanford, and then one thing why this matters, and talk if you want. Governor Sanford, you may remember, kind of tall, good-looking, very tanned guy from South Carolina, presidential prospect, had been on the cover of Time magazine, I believe, was really had a very bright future until he went on national television, or first he disappeared, and then he went on national television to talk about the Appalachian Trail. Does anyone remember this, the Appalachian Trail? You know the Appalachian Trail? You know, it goes all the way down to Argentina. It actually goes across Panama, all the way down, where he had led them into the arms of his mistress. And one of the great acts of political theater, he went on TV, he cried, he apologized, and then he started ripping biblical. And he started thanking C Street. And this was really something new, because one of the first rules of C Street is you don't talk about C Street. Doug Coe refers to what the organization says, we are an invisible organization. They like to call themselves jokingly the Christian Mafia. They believe that they can have more influence if they stay behind the scenes. This is true. This is why we have laws about disclosure and lobbying and so on. They rejected those laws. They did not find them interesting. They wanted to just minister to guys like Governor Sanford and his wife, Jenny Sanford. Jenny Sanford, who went to them for counsel when her husband's eye was wandering, and as she reports, was advised that as a biblical wife, to a chosen man, she had a responsibility. She should never speak to her husband in anger. She should not even raise the issue. The men of C Street, the brothers of the family, would deal with this with him. But it wasn't that she was to be passive. She did have something she could do. She could contribute to bringing in the kingdom. She was, and I kid you not, this is vulgar, this is in her book, she was to keep the governor sexually satisfied. That was her job. That was her job as a woman, separate but equal under God. So Governor Sanford's comedy is just tragic comedy on the national stage. If you just scratched it, revealed something much more horrible, something much more brutal about controlling people's lives. And editors came and said, you want to write about this again? And I said, no, I didn't want to write about Ensign. I didn't write about Sanford. I'd written about these things. And then Sanford came out and he explained why he was going to remain in office, although he had called upon Clinton to resign in similar circumstances. See, the difference was Clinton wasn't president. Mark Sanford, Governor Sanford, was more like a king. He said, King David, to be specific. He says, I'm like King David. David sinned mightily, and yet he was still chosen. And that's when I knew I had to return to the story, because that's one of the stories that had encountered, that set me off on this whole thing in the beginning when I was living at Ivanwald. The King David story, the portion of King David's story, is a central theological idea. Some of you may remember King David is, he spies this woman Bathsheba, and he thinks she's very beautiful, and he tells his servants to bring her to him. And she's married to one of his military leaders who's off fighting the war, and he wants to get that guy out of the way. So he arranges to have him killed. He says, get him to the front lines, then fall back so he's left out on his own and he will be killed and Bathsheba can be mine. And yet, he's still chosen. So he's a murderer, and depending on your biblical scholarship, possibly a rapist, but he's still chosen. And that's what Mark Sanford says, entitles him to remain in power. And that's what the family taught him. He said, I learned this at C Street. So I returned to the subject, and I wanted to bring it up into the present through those scandals, to thinking about desire, democracy, and public life, and to bring into some of the other stories that I've encountered since I published the last book about the presence of fundamentalism in the military. And we can talk about that in the Q&A if you want, but that's a big part of the book. But the thing that I want to close with is in Uganda, far off Uganda. And you know, just as I had before tried to talk in the media about Somalia, no one was interested. This time they were interested in Uganda. So we start with the petty transgressions of Mark Sanford and some of the men who were advising him, like Senator Jim Inhofe. I start looking at Senator Jim Inhofe from Oklahoma. I start following his travels. The family has been paying for politicians to go and spread the gospel around the world. Senator Coburn, for instance, goes to Lebanon and talks about how the solution for the Muslim-Jewish divide in that area is Christianity. And he does this as a U.S. Senator representing you. Senator Inhofe has always felt that he's better than that because he doesn't take the family's money when he goes and travels. He does not let himself get money. He does it on your dime. He is proud. He says, I use taxpayer money to promote the political ideas of Jesus as taught to me by the family. He's very candid, very, very honest man. We should admire him for that. And one of the places where he's been especially active is in Uganda, which has become sort of a focal point for family activism over the years. This East African country, which the United States is pouring billions of with a B, and foreign aid, a country that is also fighting a proxy war for us in Somalia right now. A country in which we're very entangled. And one of the people he met in Uganda was a young politician named David Bahati, who became the leader of the family's movement in the Ugandan parliament. He came here, he visited C Street, he visited Ivanwald, he came to the National Prayer Breakfast. He was very inspired by this message, and he wanted to put biblical principles into action. Working with the family group in the Ugandan parliament, he came up with something called the Anti-Homosexuality Bill. This is the most draconian anti-gay bill in the world, far worse even than Saudi Arabia. One homosexual act, life imprisonment; two, death. For promotion, talking about it like I am, and you are engaged in this by listening, 7 years in prison. If you're heterosexual and you know someone who's homosexual and you fail to report them within 24 hours, 3 years in prison. It is the most anti-gay piece of legislation in the world. He has worked through family groups in other African countries to share these ideas, they're trying to promote them. I should say the Americans are quite aghast. This goes much further than they had imagined. Even Senator Inhofe, back when the first campaign for Senate, ran on the idea of God, gays, and guns. Too much. But they had kind of encouraged something. They had poured money into it. They had poured ideas into it. And David Bahati, who I went to Uganda to visit with, said, I am fulfilling what we're really trying to do. So I went and spent some time with David Bahati. He had heard me talking about this on TV, and he got angry at me and invited me to come to Uganda to learn the truth. And when someone's planning a genocide and invites you for lunch, that would be an interesting lunch. Well, as Jenny and I were saying, I don't believe in common ground, but we did have a common table. He did have his servants cook me a delightful lunch. So that, again, is in his favor. Lunch genocide. Let's hope there's nothing happening for his sake. But I want to share one happy story. I want to end on a happy story from the book. And this is actually from some of the activists in Uganda. A person named Julius Makasa, and I'm writing here about another activist named Blessed. You'll hear this young man named Blessed, who's a gay activist, as is Julius Makasa. And this was a landmark case in Uganda. As a child, Julie Makasa knew she was attracted to children of the same sex. She had been raised Catholic, but had joined an American-style Pentecostal church, hoping that the music and the dancing and the Holy Ghost, the ecstasy, she would find the resolution of her desires. But Julie Makasa was not skilled at leading two lives. She dressed as Victor. She couldn't think dressed like a girl. So Pastor determined that she was possessed by a male spirit and asked his flock to help him heal her. The exorcism took place at the altar in front of 1,000 Christians. Boys and men from the church's healing ministry laying on hands and speaking in tongues as the women in the pews swayed and sang for Makasa's liberation. as the pastor called it, her freedom. They took her arms, gently and then firmly, and then they held her and stripped her, slowly, garment by garment, praying over each piece of demonically infused cloth. She had bound her breasts. They bared them. I cried, and every time I cried, they would call it liberation. They slapped her, but they said it was holy slapping. And when she stood before them completely naked, the men's hands roaming over her body and then inside, they said that was holy too. Then they locked her in a room and raped her for a week. This is known as a corrective, a medical procedure, a cure. When it was all over, the pastor declared that the church had freed Mikasa, and maybe in a sense it had. Victor Mikasa no longer believed there was a demon inside him. The demons were in that church. Mikasa became a man and an activist, determined to prevent what had happened to him from happening again. In 2003, he co-founded Freedom in Rome, Uganda, an organization for lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and intersex human rights. In 2005, Ugandan police, led by government officials, raided his house. They didn't find Mikasa, but a friend, Yvonne Hoyu, was there. They took her down to the station. They stripped her. "You look like a man," they said. "We're going to prove you're a woman." It happened again. Mikasa fled, but in hiding and then in exile, he planned. The plan wasn't lesbian, it wasn't gay, it was human. It was a citizen's plan. Mikasa sued, and never was a lawsuit more like a gift of the spirit, the romance of the rule of law. The happy ending is, he won. In Uganda, this country where the idea of genocide has been set on simmer, where the culture wars of the United States have been amped up on steroids, where the things that we fight about are matters now, they are of life and death, there is still a rule of law. And people engaged by the rule of law are still debating it. And that debate is a fierce debate. Victor Mikasa is not looking for common ground with David Bahati. This is something else. They're looking to make noise. And the way I'll close is with a saying that to me is the antidote to this idea of beyond the din of vox populi, the metaphor that really brings together the cacophony choir, comes from our worst president in United States history, James Buchanan. It's not George W. Bush. James Buchanan, right before Abraham Lincoln, sympathetic to the South, he had one good thought at a point when people were saying, well, let's calm things down, let's have harmony. You know, maybe we in the South can get along. And he, remember, he's on the South. But he says, you know, maybe we can have common ground, we can have master and slave, North and South, just live together. We don't have to change things. Buchanan stood up for debate, fierce debate. He said, I like the noise of democracy. The noise of democracy, not the stability of democracy, the noise of democracy, the loud, raucous bravery that is exemplified by Victor Mikasa in Uganda, and in many ways by you in this room who are speaking out for humanist values in a society that would like to tell us that we all share the common ground of faith, some kind of faith, as Eisenhower said, we just all have to believe in something. I'd like the noise of democracy that you folks bring to that, to this space, where we can really have an argument. So I'll end on that, on a note of argument, and if you have some arguments for me, I'd love to. Killing the Buddha, Heretic's Bible. People thought it was this anti-Buddhist thing, but it's actually this kind of neat Buddhist idea of the Buddha that you meet is not the real Buddha when you think you have all the answers when you start asking tough questions. We Have Him When I Die is a collection of narrative nonfiction portraits of mostly some good guys, I think. After 10 years spent with the family in C Street and Fundamentalists, I wanted to hear people who were coming bringing a kind of a challenge to that lowest common denominator way of thinking. So kind of eccentrics, true believers, true doubters all together in the American brain.
Can we follow the money? Do we know where the family gets its money, and how is it interconnected with other big sources of conservative funding?
Well, there's a lot of nonprofits. The sort of mothership nonprofit is called the Fellowship Foundation. On paper, it doesn't look that big. It's got about $17 million a year on its tax forms, and something like $12 million of which is designated for making friends as a non-taxable. I don't know if you all tried that in your but the money has historically come from the kind of, sometimes big business, but oftentimes sort of the little businessmen of the provinces who are flattered by the idea that they could come to Washington. You know, they've made their millions in quarrying or franchises and so on. And the family says, you want to play golf with, you know, Senator Inhofe? And that's a very seductive idea to these guys if they're going to be influential. And for this book, in fact, I ended up working with the son of one of these men, a guy had done well in oil, and this young man had been raised in the family, raised to believe it, and had gone to college and had taken philosophy courses and had come out and said, Dad, why didn't you never tell me about this whole broader world of ideas? And started sort of document dumping, financial documents, and all sorts of things. And using that actually in this book, and working with another reporter, we were able to trace. There's so many, there's that mothership of $17 million, but as they say, that's an incubator, that's the spin off many organizations. So we found one organization, for instance, created in 2004 with a $500,000 anonymous gift. It did one thing, it sent Congressman Bob Aderholt from Alabama, a very right wing Republican, to Sri Lanka. At that point, the United States had cut off Sri Lanka for military aid. Were in a war with the Tamil Tigers. The government had committed too many human rights abuses. They got together in Sri Lanka. They found some common ground, and military aid left, and then eventually went up fivefold to the Sri Lankan government, which concluded the war with the Tamil Tigers by, as the UN is now discovering, massacring 30,000 civilians. The family never said a word about that. The organization that had been formed to perhaps, that had a role in getting this thing started, spent $10,000, sent Congressman Aderholt, and then dissolved itself, mission accomplished, and gave the other $490,000 of the anonymous gift to the Fellowship Foundation, with whom on its tax forms it reported no involvement. So the money is Byzantine and complex. And one of the interesting things, and maybe this might horrify you or give you heart, some of the best investigative reporting on money came not from the secular press, and not even from the liberal religious press, but from the World Magazine, which is the leading right-wing fundamentalist magazine. They are fundamentalist right-wing Christians. But they don't like it when you compare Jesus to Hitler as fundamentalist Christians. They don't like that idea. They don't like it when a religious group helps cover up payoffs for ministers. And so they started following the money and uncovering any number of sort of red flags, tax dodges. As a result of this work, C Street lost its tax exempt status. That was one of the small groups. There's Military Religious Freedom Foundation, which some of you know, because of so much overlap with the family and their cause that they're fighting for and against, I guess, in the military, for again the sort of fundamentals of the military. They have been sort of taking steps to challenging the tax exempt status of the whole thing. There's another group called Clergy Voice, which is liberal pastors who have been very effective on fighting for separation of church and state, and they have been challenging the IRS exemptions for this organization. But it is there's a lot of money trails to follow. Some of them lead to prison. One of the leaders of the group pled guilty this past summer to illegal lobbying for a terrorist organization, which was a front for the Sudanese government. He said we shouldn't have sanctions on them. Through oil, we can find, you know, common love. And he was breaking the law and laundering the money through the family, and he's now facing a 15-year prison sentence after doing that. So there's these little small victories, but there's a lot to uncover.
Thank you so much for your work. and thank you for coming to speak to us today. I have a two-part question. First part, I'm wondering, as a journalist and a writer, why did they allow you to become into a part of the family? Did they think you were going to be a great, powerful leader, or what? What was their reasons, in your view, for letting you be involved in the family? And secondly, you've sort of touched on this already a little bit. This organization seems so extremely un-American, undemocratic, and very un-Christian, even, I would say. I would think most Christians would think that. Now that it's been exposed, you know, how is it able to still function, in your view? What has there been, you've mentioned some of the outcomes, but is there a wider scandal and outrage against what they're doing, especially, you know, since they're involved with political leaders? Are other political leaders denouncing them, or what kind of fallout? I would think there would be tremendous scandalous fallout from this.
Well, let me
I'm curious to hear about that too.
Yeah, let me take that second part first, because when the scandals broke in 2009, the sex scandals in C Street, and I did tons of media, and suddenly other people were doing investigation, I was sure that would be the end of C Street. Now, they have a lot of real estate. That's, you know, C Street's not the main event. It's this beautiful $8 million mansion in Arlington called the Cedars. The house I lived in was called Ivanhoe, which was actually bought for them by an oilman in Denver. That's, again, how that money goes. But I was sure that C Street would go out of business, because what congressman, it's all men, was going to move to Washington and tell his wife, hey, I'm going to be bunking in that house where they, you know, help cover up your affairs. Well, Congressman E. Schuller, the very right-wing Democrat from North Carolina, was so proud of his residence there that something did change. He said he invited a local TV station in and said, look at what a great place this is for the guys. It did become tense, and I think they lost allies, even among conservatives. Ann Ryan, the wife of former Congressman Jim Ryan, very fundamentalist right-wing, she came out and said, this place is anti-woman. They tried to get my husband to live there. He didn't want to do it. I knew what to do. It's clear to us. We know them. We know these people for years. It's the idea of dividing men from their wives, from their families, and making their only loyalty to this organization. And it goes on. They did get a lot of bad publicity, especially the Uganda stuff. You know, they lost tax-exempt statuses. Organizations fighting them on different fronts. At the National Prayer Breakfast, their annual event, which is very banal and sort of seemingly ecumenical, but the internal documents say it's a recruiting event. They said anything can happen, even the Quran can be read, but Jesus is there. He's infiltrating the world. That's what they describe as what's going on there. And there's pressure for foreign politicians not to go. They took some steps toward transparency. The step toward transparency was they started working with Pastor Rick Warren's PR guy to whitewash the record. And they actually, someone has been telling reporters that the bill, this horrible bill in Uganda, has been defeated, and the family led the fight. And reporters, American reporters, are unfortunately dutifully reporting that, even though the bill is still active. And all you need to do is call up the bill sponsor, and it says, nobody ever told me to back off. In fact, they told me we were still brothers. So there's been some progress, but not much. And there's also all kinds of little local investigations going on in papers all around the country. You know, Michigan, local reporters giving Congressman Bart Stupak, who's the guy who lived in the C Street house, the Stupak Pitts anti-abortion amendment, giving him a hard time. Out in Kansas, local TV news, you know, it leads at Leeds TV News. Local TV news did an investigative report of Congressman Todd Tehart, who I had reported at C Street talking about how we have to win the race with the Muslim. Muslims have too many babies, and we, meaning I suppose American Christians, don't have enough. We're aborting all of our, that was his rhetoric. Local TV news had investigated him. So all these little scandals going. So that's where that's at. The reason they let me in, and maybe this is also good news too, the great incompetence of the right. I sometimes sort of get represented, you know, people say you went undercover, and it's like this very dramatic thing, like, you know, like I'm James Bond, you know, Scott. I mean, look at James Bond. I'm Inspector Clouseau, you know. I just sort of bumble up. I went in on my, this is a story I tell in the beginning of the first book, The Family. You only get in by being recommended, and this guy I'd known for many years said, you should go and see this, and it had changed his life. And I said, you know, I don't share your beliefs. And he says, it doesn't matter. You don't have to believe. You just have to obey. And I said, yeah. And I went, I told him I was working on a book called Killing the Buddha. Maybe they took it the wrong way. I don't know. I was complete disclosure. As for comprehension, that's their responsibility. I used my own name. I was there as myself. And there was a sense that I think they so deeply believe that what they're doing is good and right, that they always had a hard time understanding why, how anyone could be disturbed by this. And there's also the fact that I'm half Jewish, and I kind of like that. A Jew bows before Jesus. This is nice. This proves that Jesus is the one. They let me in and made me a member for a long time. And I think, though, I do have the distinction of being the only, and this is incredible, I'm the only person who's been excommunicated from the family. Not Papa Doc, he never was. After World War II, they became champions of various former Nazi war criminals, who they said, but they've seen the light, they're very sorry for what they did, and we should forgive them. Those guys get forgiveness, not me, so they won't make that mistake twice, I guess. But boy, they made it good the first time.
Yes, thank you. It seems to me that the family would greatly admire the Howard Moore character from the Fountainhead. And I get the impression from what you're saying and from what I've read about the family that it's sort of like Ayn Randian objectivism with a crucifix on the wall. Would that be an accurate statement? And how do they feel about Ayn Rand? Did it mention anything to you?
A lot of them personally liked Ayn Rand, but of course she was an atheist. And very, very fierce about that. Mark Sanford, that great theological and philosophical thinker, reconciles these two. After his scandal, trying to redeem himself, he wrote an article for Newsweek called Atlas Hugged. He said he had erred. You know why he had had this mistress? Because he had been too devoted to Ayn Rand. Now, it is true that Ayn Rand, as some of you may know, was sort of famous for sleeping with her in her circle, but that wasn't it, that he was too selfish. He had been too seduced by selfish. So what he needed to do was take a little bit of Ayn Rand and a little bit of Bible. And he said, these are the two books that I always keep in my shelf, Ayn Rand and the Bible. So they might not seem to go together, but really they're a perfect match. And you get, you know, this mashup of Atlas Hugged. And so, yeah, I think that does sum up very, very aptly.
So I have a question about the money. This seems to be a big problem. So the religious left, which claims to exist, and, you know, the biggest example is Sojourner's Jim Wallace's organization.
The religious right.
Right. That's funded largely by George Soros, who's an atheist. Now, it seems to me that the organizations on the far right of Christianity are not funded by, you know, secular atheists. They're actually funded by religious believers. How can the religious left or any real challenge to the religious right exist if it's not, if there are no people from the actual churches supporting it, and if it's, the funding is coming from atheists and other people outside of their own belief system?
Well, I mean, you made a couple points there. Jim Wallace, some people are familiar with, sort of has this reputation as the religious left, despite the fact that he's anti-gay and anti-reproductive rights, and fundamentally anti-democratic. Remember, Jerry Falwell says we do X, Y, and Z because the Bible says so. Jim Wallace says we do some other things, some things that I'm in sympathy with, you know, healthcare. We do it because the Bible says so. And meanwhile, the noise of democracy says we don't do anything because the Bible says so in America. If you want to do it because the Bible says so, that's fine, but we do things because the people say so. So it's not really the religious left. I mean, it's kind of hijacked that term. The money, they can't compete. They're not even close. I remember some years ago, there was a little Sojourner project that had raised, that's his organization, they had $200,000 for a national outreach then. And I had just come back from a mega church in Colorado Springs. Not the biggest by a long shot. It was actually the 99th biggest. Typical Sunday afternoon, the collection plate goes out, they raised $300,000. You're not going to win that money raise. And then you get into sort of the corporations that are funding. And, you know, Soros can do whatever, all that he wants to try and sort of balance all the right. But that, I don't think that's where, I don't think that, not going to win. You know, the family can be drawn, you know, for years, the part of their headquarters, the Cedars, was paid for with money from the CEO of Raytheon, the defense contractor. When Doug Coe flies around the world, he flies on private jets, sometimes donated by oil executives. These are cynical men. They understand what they're getting. I don't think you try and compete on the money. I think we, you know, what we have, again, and this sounds sentimental, but it's the noise of democracy and the voices. And, you know, it sounds sentimental, but I think in Egypt, they've already showed us once, and now that new military government's trying to crack down, and they're trying to show us again, noise of democracy is quite effective, and can trump these guys.
On the money trail, I have a question about methodology from your perspective. In the responsible food movement, there has been a very effective PDF file that's been floating around the internet that's actually a picture. It's a graphical representation of what companies own which greenwashed brand labels. Have you ever considered graphically mapping out the social networks of the people that you describe in the family? I mean, for example, the connection not only to the leadership in Uganda, but also to their spiritual side, you know, pastors like Maurice Sempa.
Yeah, I'm all for that. And I've done some of it, and you know, there's, you know, I've given you a few examples. There's lots more in the book about how this sort of money is flowing, but that big kind of financial research, I haven't done. And to a certain extent, 10 years with the fundamentalists, I feel like I've done my bit. I also, because I like the idea of the Coffin Choir, I mean, that thing I mentioned before, all these little local investigations taking place all over the country, or other organizations, the Military Religious Freedom Foundation, noticing that the biggest building for the last couple of years in the military, the biggest new building funds, are going to building sort of mega church chapels on military bases. And then the researcher for that organization, Chris Rada, said, well, who's doing this? And this guy named Zach Womp, Representative Zach Womp from Tennessee, who is a longtime Sea Streeter, and he's got a little military appropriation subcommittee for new buildings. The whole thing, she noticed, was all family brothers, and they're all funneling this money. They're even turning down money for religious buildings that they don't like. For instance, at Dover Air Force Base, there was a small request from now Senator Mike Castle, a kind of Republican, not part of the family, that's not his thing, a traditional Catholic, I believe. He wanted a new chapel at Dover Air Force Base because the chapel with which families who were religious met the dead coming home. The chapel had been damaged, they couldn't use it anymore. He wanted a small amount of money for a new chapel. This committee said, no, we can't afford that. But we've got millions from mega church style chapels at Fort Riley, at Fort Hood, at military bases all over the country. So that's something, I mean, that itself is such a vast project. You start looking at the contractors who are engaged in that, and that organization is doing that. I'm more interested in the sort of the cacophony choir model of investigative reporting. One reporter who claims to own the story is lying. The story's gotta be bigger than what I can do. And, you know, again, I also see this overseas. There's been people investigating money trails in Uganda, even people within the family when they encounter, because so many people get involved with the best of intentions. Right before this book came out, I got an email from a guy who ran an orphanage in South Africa, and his money was brought to him through the family. And he had been notified, hey, there's this book coming out, it's going to be some bad press for us. You will probably want to transfer all your funds so it doesn't appear to be connected to us. And this guy, who was a, you know, conservative Christian, wrote me and said, I haven't read your book yet, but you know, after having worked with these guys for years, I'm now inclined to believe you, because what kind of organization would tell me to hide my funding stream if there's nothing to hide? So he says, I'm just not gonna work with them anymore. But that, you know, the extent of that funding is so vast, the map is a good idea, and if what the humanist organization wants to take it on, go. I'll give you all my notes. it's too big for me to take on by myself. And I think that's not the way reporting should be done.
We'll make this the last question, okay?
This seems so ingrained. What is your sense of the future? Are you optimistic or pessimistic? Or all these little cacophonies of contributions that it seems like they're deeply invested?
Well, that is actually one of the larger arguments of the family, which has some chapters on early revivals. Jonathan Edwards, pre-American, 1735, First Great Awakening, Charles Grandison Finney. And I think there's an idea popular among secularists that the religious right came out of nowhere, you know, 1976 or 1980 or 1988, wherever you want to date it, the Mormon majority of the Christian coalition, and that this is an aberration in American life. It's not true. This is not an advocacy. It's not true. It's been revival. It's been a part of American DNA from the beginning. These fights, you know, people were fond of saying that the Constitution is a godless document. It is indeed, because that side won the argument at the Constitutional Convention, but there's plenty of people there who didn't want it to be a godless document. This is an ongoing argument. So to a certain extent, maybe that's optimistic. I don't think we're going to lose. I think the argument's going to keep going. This organization in particular, they took a pretty rough hit, I think, but they did weather it. They're still there. There was some question whether Obama would go to the National Prayer Breakfast last year. There was a lot of organizations asking him not to, including clergy people. He went. That was the whole idea of the National Prayer Breakfast. What president is going to come out and say, I'm against prayer? And that's the way they're framing the language. Either you're for prayer, in which case you go to their event, or you're against prayer. You know, so he has to go. But the one interesting thing that happened is that there's some within the organization who says, you know what, we should be more transparent. They take tiny, baby steps. They made a website. They made a website and then they bought Google ads, because when you Google me, not that I know, you get them instead. So we are one. I guess I'm still a member. But these tiny steps where they in fact sort of regularize, institutionalize, that does make them more accountable. And I think you start seeing other Christian organizations sort of being wary of them and saying, where's the money coming from and where's it going? We've got to account for this. And the end of that process is them becoming just another religious advocacy organization. And one that's very easy for us to argue. There's a lot of people, I'll close on this, a lot of people who don't like fundamentalists like Pat Robertson or James Dobson and those guys I'm fine with. I disagree with everything they say. They're part of the noise of democracy, and they're out there in the public square, and you know you disagree with what they say because they say it so loudly. They're out there arguing and fighting and ringing their, and when it's out there in the open, we can have that argument over it. We can have that debate, and we can hopefully win that debate with those forces of fundamentalism. So the future, I hope, is this group being pushed, pulled, and venturing forward into the public square where it will be greeted by this noise.
Just about reached the finish line, but I can't help but think what an excellent segue Jeff's talk makes to the real mission of the American Humanist Association, because if the religious right has grown so strong in America, certainly it has a lot to do with our demographic having been so marginalized for so long. And it really points to what we need to do as an organization and as secular Americans. If the secular American demographic, if humanists can become a respected, recognized part of American culture and American society, there's no way that the religious right can assert the kind of muscle that it currently asserts and that it's asserted over the last few decades. We really need to build up our demographic and really show the public and the media that we are part of the American tapestry, that when public policy is being suggested and proposed, that people have to ask, gee, what do secular Americans think of this? How does this affect secular Americans? These questions are not even being asked currently, but this is the mission, this is what we're trying to do, and thank you, Jeff, for just providing a perfect segue into the mission and what we're all about as an organization. So thank you.